Welcome. Thank you for coming. It's a big turnout for the first session after lunch, so that's very cool. I'm thinking that either means that you guys are really interested in security and compliance, or you thought this was far enough away that you could come and take a nap in here and nobody really noticed. So I'm hoping it's the former, but let's see how it goes. So what we did with this session, or I should start with, my name is Michael Richards. I'm a productivity specialist for Office 365 based in our Sydney office. And so I mainly work with our government and finance customers. And so what I've done with this presentation is, there's a couple of presentations that we're doing in other areas, one for security and one for compliance. And in the interest of time, we kind of took the best bits from each and merged it into one and just sort of figured we'd give you a quick update on what's changed, what you may have missed in the last 6 months or so. There's another presentation tomorrow that that James and Simon are doing, so that'll go into a little bit more detail, some of the real-world application of some of these things. There's also a presentation that Ben's doing on some of the data ingestion, so the archiving sort of things. So I've got some links in the deck for the times for those, but you might want to go and see those sessions as well. So I figured I'd just cut through a lot of the context, because hopefully you guys all know why we're here. Actually, I should have said, how many of you have actually seen a Microsoft security presentation before? Whether it's at a conference like this, or a recording, or we come and talk to you? Okay. So not quite as many as I thought, but I think that's okay. I do have some links at the end of the deck to some presentations that we did at Ignite earlier this year, and they do cover sort of more of the overview sort of stuff, how we actually do protection of the service. I wanted to focus more on what you guys can do, what you can control, to meet your own requirements. But essentially, you know, single sort of context slide, really, I probably don't have to tell you things have changed over the last few years. You know, work is now something that we do, not somewhere we go. It shouldn't matter whether I am sitting in an office on a device that my company has provided, or I'm using my own personal device sitting in a cafe down by the beach somewhere. I need to get work done. You know, I as a user don't really care about the rest. But that brings up some interesting challenges for you as the organization. How do you control that data? How do you make sure that that's safe? How do you still meet all of your regulatory requirements? So we can help you with Office 365. We think we've got a pretty solid solution. But in order to do that, you have to trust us. And we understand that's a pretty big deal. We have to earn that trust. And so that we've worked very, very hard. We've been very transparent about how we operate the service. You've probably seen that in the past through things like the Office 365 Trust Center. So we've taken a lot of the information on how we run the service. We've given you audit reports, all of this information available to you through the Trust Center. If you need additional information, then we've been able to do that under non-disclosure agreement, come to your account team. You know, we can get you audit reports and other things that might be a little bit more restricted. So we've tried to be very, very transparent about the service in general. But we want to take that further now. So we're looking at things like the operational controls. Those are the things that we do for you. So how are we protecting the service? What sort of enhancements are we adding in that's going to give you better security, that's going to make sure your privacy of your data is protected? How do we make sure that we're demonstrating compliance with the requirements that we have? How are we helping you to demonstrate compliance with the requirements that you have? And then the other piece up the top there is the organizational controls. So again, this is really about information protection. How are you going to protect your information? Because every customer is different. We're not building a service for finance or for government or for energy or whatever the case may be. We're building a standard service, and you guys need to take that and tailor it to your individual requirements. So when we look at how we do that, we're basically breaking it down into some of these features for security. So things like multi-factor authentication, things like data loss prevention, antivirus and anti-spam are kind of an obvious one. We have a new capability that we've added in called advanced threat protection that we'll be taking you through today. Mobile device management and mobile application management. Did you see the announcement overnight on mobile application management, being able to do that outside of the scope of the full MDM, so we can actually get in there and manage the applications without having to have full management of the device. So we'll talk about that as well. And then encryption, always a big topic. So we'll talk about encryption at rest, how you can actually do encryption of your content through rights management services, through things like Office 365 message encryption, and other solutions in there. And then compliance as well. So typically when we talk about compliance, we're talking about things like e-discovery, archiving and retention of your data, auditing so that you know what's going on in your environment. So all of those things sort of help you with your regulatory compliance. How do you demonstrate you're compliant with X regulation that you have, depending on your industry? But there's obviously going to be some overlap, because in order to get to demonstrate compliance with certain regulations, you're going to use some of these security features. You know, I want to demonstrate PCI compliance. I'm going to use things like DLP to identify credit cards going through the environment and block that so that we're not storing that information. So those sorts of things. If we start with security, There's kind of two pivots that we look at. The first one, again, is that service level capabilities. So we're building a generic secure service. We're not building it for a particular industry. So these are the things that we've learned through operating secure services for a number of, you know, almost two decades, actually. And these are the things that we largely do on your part. So we have to be transparent about them. We have to tell you how they work. You have to be aware, because it does have an impact on your security position, on your compliance position. But a lot of it is sort of stuff that you don't necessarily control. And the customer controls is really where you get, we give you dials and switches and things that you can flip and tailor the environment. I wasn't going to talk through this, I guess just because there is a large group that hasn't seen the presentation before. We have a defense in depth strategy for how we protect the environment. So it's quite a comprehensive framework. Obviously, it goes through multiple levels. So we're looking at everything from the physical security of our data centers, nondescript buildings, you have to have multi-factor authentication, you can't just turn up, you've got to be pre-registered. All of those sorts of things. Individual network level isolation, so the front end pieces of an environment, so your exchange servers potentially are locked down from other servers. We're just looking at the traffic flows that are necessary. Because we can be very specific about the role, we can be very, very specific about the communication. So a SQL server should be able to talk to, or a SharePoint server should be able to talk to SQL server and the directory, but it shouldn't be able to go and touch Active Directory, Exchange or anything like that. So very specific segmentation within our networks and then within our services as well. Host isolation. Application development, at the application layer, we have the security development lifecycle. So you're hopefully aware that we took all our developers offline way back in 2001 with the Trustworthy Computing Initiative. So security is at the heart of our development. And it's really the, it's at the basis there. Very, very strong checks around our administrators. So we're going to come back to this one a little bit in a moment. But the people who are actually running the data centers don't have any access to what's in the data center. So the guys on the floor in the data center are the people who are doing physical security, so letting you in and out of the building. They're the guys that run the power and the water. And basically, new equipment comes in, they plug in power and network to a container, or they plug in servers into a rack. And that's pretty much it. Everything is built remotely. Everything is operated from centralized operation centers. The guys who are able to walk around the data center floor don't know that's an Exchange server, that's a SharePoint server. They don't know that Exchange server has X customers' data on it. It's completely isolated from them. We do a whole lot of other things around our administrators, of course, background checks to different levels depending on the sensitivity of the data, the training that we make them go through, all of those sorts of things, and again, we'll come back to that. And then continuous protection of the data as well. So a lot of this is stuff that we're going to expose to you. They will go into more detail on this in the presentations that I referenced from Chicago back at the start of the year. So if you are interested in that, obviously come talk to me afterwards. I'm going to be around after this or tonight at the drink session. But that's also described in more detail in those recordings. I wanted to focus on a couple of areas though, and this is very specifically around this idea of vulnerability assessments or penetration testing, because we often get asked this by our customers. So as part of our regulatory compliance, we obviously do independent vulnerability assessments on a regular basis. You know, we have to do it at least once a year as part of that compliance. It may happen at other times during the year, so we have that commitment. But we don't just stop there. So that's fine, that's for compliance perspective. From our own service management, we have a group of people at Microsoft called the Red Team. And their sole job at Microsoft is to attack Office 365 and try and find weaknesses. So these people are exactly who you expect them to be. They're former military, former intelligence agencies, PhD, academia, all these sorts of things. So they're experts in their field. And they just attack Office 365. Now, there are obviously some rules. We can't have them doing denial of service attacks and bringing down Office 365 for all our customers. That would be pretty bad. So they have some very strict guidelines on how they engage. They can't target customer data. They have to go after very specific Microsoft environments that we've set up for this. But it doesn't really matter at that point, because we're looking at how they're getting in or what they're doing. But they'll look at what's happening in the industry. They'll see that somebody's been, this company was breached, and this is how it happened. So they'll take that knowledge and they'll go and they'll replay it inside our organization and see what happens. Or they'll target our administrators with social engineering attacks. So they'll send out an email that says, click here to win a Surface Pro 3 and try and get their credentials that way. Or we've got a major incident, the FBI needs this data, can you hand this data over? So we're testing our own operational procedures as well. All of this information goes into this is generating signals that we're hopefully trapping through our event monitoring systems. We have a blue team that's basically sitting opposite the red team. So the blue team monitors the environment. They're looking at the analytics that are coming out of our machine learning layer that's looking at predictive behavior. So you can see that a typical administrator would log on and then do A and then B and then C and then D. So if we log on, if we see somebody log on from a computer we've never seen before and all of a sudden they go straight to action D, that's a signal that we should be flagging. So the blue team will see that coming out of the Cosmos platform. They'll act on that. That's hopefully a red team attack. We can trap them. Obviously, like later on, they can get together and look at, you know, how long was I in the system? How did you detect me? How were you able to shut me out? All of those sorts of things. So this is happening on an ongoing basis. Okay, so we get asked for penetration test reports or that sort of thing. We have those from a compliance perspective, but this happens on a daily basis. We're constantly testing our environment. So the follow-on from that that we usually get is, okay, so I, as a customer, how can I do this myself? And you can now. So we have this thing called the bug bounty program. Again, there's conditions. So you can't just go and do your own attack against Office 365. There are some conditions that you have to work within. Targeting your own tenant, can't do things that are gonna do, you know, mass impact, like a denial of service attack. But you can do your own vulnerability assessments, you can run your own penetration testing. If you do find something, we'll pay you for that. So there are bounties that we pay for this. So I think that's a pretty big deal as well. It's often requested by our customers. So going back to trust, how do we earn your trust? Why am I losing half my screen? Oh, no, it's all right. Okay, so yeah, earning your trust. So in order to do that, to demonstrate that you still have control and you have transparency over the environment, we've invested in a number of areas, so specifically around the security and compliance signals. You've already seen, hopefully, that we have a reporting system inside Office 365. So there's some reports coming out of there and you can take some of that data and feed it into your own platform. We're going further with a activity API, so we'll talk about that one. So that's really a transparency thing. On the control side, we have advanced encryption. So being able to do things like encrypting the data at rest and even doing bring your own key on top of that so that you have control over that information. And then in the middle, the intersection is really this thing called customer lockbox. So this is really the piece that manages how Microsoft gets access to your data. So let's take a look at these in more detail. So for us to give you true transparency to the service, you need to know everything that's going on. So basically the new management activity API is looking for anything that a human does inside Office 365, whether that's your individual users, your administrators, whether that's us doing things to the service. Anything that a human initiates should generate an action. These all apply consistently across the service, so it's applying to everything, Exchange, SharePoint, OneDrive for Business, changing the tenant details. It's all feeding into a web service that's specifically been designed for this sort of platform. So it's actually the work that we did with our big data platform, the Cosmos engine, the thing that the blue team is using. That work led into this development because you can imagine in that environment, we have terabytes of log data that's coming through every day, you know, petabytes of data being stored and analyzed and sifted through machine learning. So all of that has been made available and we're using the same sort of thing to give you this capability as a customer. So now that we have that activity API, we can start pumping that into different services. And you probably are using some of these solutions today, security event monitoring solutions or cloud access security brokers. So the activity API is something that these partners have signed on to utilize and they can bring that information into their particular product and then do their own specific things with that. So there is an announcement that talks about the preview program for this, and it can go into some more detail if you wanted to read up on that. Or obviously, if you are using one of these products, then I would suggest you talk to your vendor about how they're going to implement it and what additional capabilities that will give you. So encryption. Encryption's an interesting topic. I think that the big thing that we find with encryption is it's often cited as a requirement. We must have encryption at rest. So the unasked question there is why? Why do you need encryption at rest? What is that doing for you? So we'll put a pin in that and we'll come back to it. We started with encryption at rest. Let's focus on SharePoint. We started with encryption at rest and said, all right, the requirement is we have encryption at rest. So what's the easiest way to achieve that? We put BitLocker on the disk. The disk is now encrypted. We've got encryption at rest. So what that means is that if you did somehow manage to identify which server and which disk had information on it that you wanted, and you somehow managed to get that outside of our secure data center environment, you're not going to be able to do anything with it because the drive is BitLocker protected, you don't have the recovery key, you can't open that up and get any data off it. So we have met the requirement for encryption at rest, but it's not very interesting. What are we mitigating? It's a backstop on our physical security controls. So what we did with SharePoint is we said, let's take that a little bit further. Let's give you some protection at the operating system level. So BitLocker's great unless you can get onto the Windows operating system. Now the disk is unencrypted, I can go and pull the database off it. And if you hopefully you know, SharePoint stores data in a SQL content database. Obviously the content database is sitting on the file system. So in order to encrypt that content, what we did was we wanted to do individual content level encryption. So every file in SharePoint should get its own encryption. The way SharePoint works is that it stores, obviously, files in the database. When we have large files or when we have files that you make changes to, SharePoint will store a chunk of data. And it does that so that it can do things like differential transfers. So if you're saving a file, we want to be able to send just the changes to that file, not make you download the entire thing or send the entire thing over again. So SharePoint's already doing this. It's already dividing your files up into little pieces. So what we said was, let's take our key service, a key store. We'll have one key, master key for the tenant. We'll generate individual keys for every single piece of content or every single chunk of data that we have in our SharePoint database. We'll take those files or those pieces of data and we'll go and store them in individual Azure containers. So now, essentially, this is basically remote blob storage. The content inside the database is an index of files. If I need this file, I need to go and get these pieces from these vaults, and this is the key to decrypt those files. So that index can be encrypted with the master key. Each of the Azure containers has its own key that rolls every 24 hours. So now, if I want to compromise your data, I have to hit three different places. And as you can imagine, this is kind of the critical piece here, the key store. We can watch that very, very closely. So anything that happens, anything that touches the key store, we can see if there's any sort of attempt on this data. Now, this is all completely transparent to you. This is operating today. This was part of the work that got us to 1 terabyte site collections in SharePoint Online, as opposed to the previous 100 gigabyte limit. So this is there today, but you don't see it. It's completely transparent to you as users or you as administrators, because this is all happening in the background. The service is doing this on your behalf. So let's look at SharePoint for a moment. Oh, sorry, Exchange. Exchange is basically, as I said, for the starting place for SharePoint. We do the same thing. We do encryption at the disk level. So every disk in an Exchange server is protected with BitLocker. So now every piece of content on the Exchange server is encrypted at rest. So again, it's a great starting place. We want to go further. So you'll see we're going to do the same sort of thing with Exchange as we're doing with SharePoint. So basically, we have our Azure Key Vault. We have a master key for the tenant. We generate keys for the content. We encrypt the content. The content goes into the database. That individual content is encrypted. So again, we've taken the content and basically abstracted this now from the Windows administrator. You might be able to get onto the Windows box. You might be able to see the database, but you can't do anything with the database because the entire content of it is encrypted. So the next thing you generally hear is, that's great, I want to control the key. Now again, the big question is why? What's the mitigation? What is this going to do for you? But we'll park that for a second. So you want to control the key. We have that today with rights management services in Azure. You can do bring your own key. So we're going to do the same sort of idea with Exchange and SharePoint. We will allow you to generate your own key in your own HSM. There'll be a key exchange ceremony so that we have a copy of your key. And then we'll use that key for the master key when we're doing the encryption for Azure and for Exchange. So now you have control of the key, or you will. But again, the question is why? What is this giving you? Why do you want to do this? And when you pull at that string a little bit with customers, usually we hear, I want to do this so that Microsoft can't access my data. Which is interesting, but let's think about that for a second. So we have a lot of really interesting capabilities that we're doing inside of Office 365. We're doing things like inspection of your data for data loss prevention, for e-discovery, simple things like antivirus scanning. You know, if you've put all of your data inside a container that we can't read, we can't do any of those things. We just made the service a very dumb platform. So we need the service to be able to read your content. So this is giving you a capability to control the key, which is important. We get it. You need the control. But it's also allowing the service to still provide those capabilities you need. So it's not going to address that scenario of Microsoft accessing my data. What it does mean, though, is that this is basically your control over your content. This is your kill switch. So if you're leaving the service, if you need to terminate the content for some reason, you decided, that's it, I don't want to use Office 365 anymore, I'm going to pull all my users out. You probably know that we keep deleted mailboxes for 30 days in case you need to recover. We're going to keep your data for 90 days by default so that you can get it back out after your contract expires. So you may not want content sitting up there in our service at that point. You know, you want to make sure that nobody can do anything with that content as it expires out of our systems. So this allows you to pull your key. All the content at that point goes completely dead, so nobody's ever going to be able to decrypt that again. But that's really what Bring Your Own Key provides. So it's a very important capability for some customers, but I don't want this to be sort of held up as the panacea, like this is the everything that we need, because it's a very specific mitigation for a specific scenario. So let's talk about Microsoft accessing your data then. Now this is not the scenario where the government comes to us and says we need to get access to customers' data, you need to hand it over. We have some pretty strong contractual controls that we make around that. And so again, they're referenced in the other presentations, but essentially this idea that we're not just gonna hand over data, somebody comes to us with a subpoena, we say go and talk to the customer, they say there's a gag order on it, you can't tell the customer about it, you have to provide the data, we go into court and challenge it because we think we should be able to notify you. We don't want access to your data. We don't need access to your data. We've put a lot of time into engineering a service that we can manage without having any access to customer data. We think that's your responsibility. We'll manage the service, you manage the data. Nice, easy line of delineation. So the exception to that is when we need to get access because there's some sort of problem with your data. So think mailbox corruption or SharePoint site corruption or something like that. We need to get in and fix something or do some sort of recovery or that sort of thing. So this is always initiated by you as the customer. You're calling in, you're making a support request, you're asking us for help. What happens is the Microsoft engineer has to go into an escalation process. They go into a tool and they put in a request to say, here's the ticket number that the customer has lodged. The problem is this. We need access for this particular reason. I'm gonna need access for a period of time, whatever that might be. It could be 4 hours, it could be 10 minutes. So they'll put all of that information into the request. And the lockbox system will go and do some checks on the user. So it'll check, are you entitled to actually make this request? Are you an exchange person trying to access SharePoint? It's probably a bad idea. Have you done your security training? Have you done all the background checks and fingerprinting and all these other things that we require of you? So all those sorts of checks in the background that are pretty standard, pretty simple, but it's handy for us to enforce that at that time of escalation. If Lockbox thinks that this looks like a good idea, we have to do the request. Because it's accessing customer data, it does route it to a manager on duty. So it's kind of the same principle as the nuclear submarine, two keys, no one person should be able to do anything. The same idea, the manager has to approve access to customer data. So it's different if they just need access to the environment to make a change on a exchange configuration or something on the operating system. If we're not touching customer data, then that's one thing. But because customer data is something that's so important, that should never be accessed unless it's absolutely necessary, we send that to the manager, and then they have to review it and decide whether or not to make that request, to allow that request. So that's the way it works today. The manager sees it. If the manager approves it, we get access. So what we're doing with customer lockbox is, again, on that idea of control, we're inserting you into the process. So after the manager has said, yes, it looks like customer access is absolutely necessary, the request then goes to the administrators that you have defined. So when you sign up for customer lockbox, because it is an extra feature that you turn on, you define who your administrators are. And we will send an email out to those people, and they'll get a message that says, you know, this person at Microsoft needs access to your data, this is the ticket number, this is the reason, do you want to approve or reject this? So you've got control. You can say approve it, and then they get in. It works on the principles of just in time and just enough access. Elevation. So nobody at Microsoft has access to your data. This is the only way they can do it. When Lockbox grants them permission, they get access to run that very specific PowerShell command against whatever it was that they requested access for, just for that period of time. If they go to lunch and the session times out, you know, if it wasn't enough access, they have to go back through Lockbox and make the request again. So, you know, we've approved it, they can go and do that, fantastic. If you say deny, or if you don't respond to the email within 12 hours, then it automatically gets rejected and there's no access to the service. There's no way around this. If you've got customer lockbox on and you don't approve the request, we can't get access to your data. Now that's okay, because again, this is specifically in regards to, you know, support requests. That's the only time we would need to access your data. They've gone back, they've looked at the logs, they've looked at all the times that customer data access was actually necessary, and they're confident that we can do this without compromising the service. If you don't want us to access that mailbox, we can't fix that problem, but if you're okay with it, then we're okay with it. So again, this is your control. This is how you demonstrate that nobody can get access to your data without you approving it. All of this is obviously audited. It's reviewed on a regular basis from a Microsoft perspective. Every month, the service owners review all of those requests that go through. You will see this as part of the ticket request as well, the ticket history. So the case number that you get when you call Microsoft support, you'll see details in there. But again, this will show up in things like the Activity API that we talked about as well. So anything that's happening in the environment, you get a log of it. So lockbox, you have transparency. Customer lockbox, you have control. All right. So what other controls can you turn in the service? So we'll go through some of these. Device protection, obviously a big one, especially in this day and age, the bring your own device scenario. Obviously, that's pretty important. Data leakage. So we have some pretty strong protection in here for data loss prevention or data leakage. Obviously, it's not meant to stop the malicious actor. There's always going to be ways that people can get around things. But what we want to do is we want to educate people when they're doing things wrong and try and help them to do it in a better way so that you can still demonstrate your compliance. So we'll go through that one. Encryption, we'll go through some additional encryption that you have, because the encryption we talked about before so far, obviously, service level encryption. So this is specifically encryption that you can control to enhance that. External threats, right to access resources, I think is a pretty simple thing. You know, you obviously have control of that, you grant permissions, you can manage that yourself. Excuse me. Okay, so from an identity perspective, your identity is key in this scenario. We have to have a common identity that all the services are going to build across. And so that's what we're using Azure Active Directory for. You can take your Active Directory on premises. You can hook that up to Azure Active Directory so the information flows up. Your ID on premises is still the master. If you want to do synchronized passwords, you can. So we take a hash of the existing password hash and we put that up in the cloud, so it's a nice secure process. But now you can sign into the cloud services using your Active Directory username and password. We can even do self-service password reset and password change and then write back to Active Directory if you want to. So, you know, people who never come into the corporate network, we do have a capability for them to actually change their password and have it flow back as part of that. Lots of other things you can do with Azure Active Directory, obviously being able to do policies on users and configure group management and all those sorts of features. Multi-factor authentication was something that we added to Office 365. So we kind of took the approach that we really want the service to be secure. Rather than charging you for the product, we give you the basic sort of capabilities as part of your subscription. If you want to go beyond that, obviously there are things you can do in the Azure service, Azure Rights Management, Azure Multi-Factor Authentication or Azure Active Directory Premium. But we have multi-factor authentication for every one of your users as part of Office 365. So there are some limitations to that, obviously. It's a per user setting when you turn it on. It's largely on or off. For the user, it's you know pretty much on. There are a couple of exceptions, but once it's on, it's on for everything. So if you want to be able to have more policy-based control, I want to do MFA only if you're accessing SharePoint, not if you're accessing Exchange. I want to initiate an MFA challenge if we see you sign in Sydney and then a minute later sign in from China. That's a suspicious activity. Maybe we should prompt you for a multi-factor authentication next time you log in. So those are things that you can turn on. You can do that with Active Directory Premium. But we do have that basic capability, and I believe James and Simon are going to talk to you about that tomorrow as well. And then some insights into the service. So we have a product called Advanced Threat Analytics that we have out there now, which can look at authentication requests and things going through your environment, start looking for suspicious patterns and alerting you on those things. Data loss prevention is something that we added to Exchange probably a couple of years ago now, actually. So the idea behind data loss prevention is we had about 51 sensitive information types. So for us in Australia, that means things like your tax file number, Medicare number, common sorts of things like credit cards and bank account numbers and those sorts of things. So we had that in Exchange, and you might have seen the policy tips before. So we could define some policies on the Exchange server, and we could say, anytime you see a credit card number in an email, if it's going inside the organization, that's okay. Maybe we'll pop a tip up to the users and say, this isn't best practice. But if you're going to try and send credit cards outside the organization, we should actually get in the way and stop that. You know, we want to prevent the user from sending it, so we'll disable the send button. Or maybe we'll allow it if they put in a business justification to override it, but we'll capture that and send it off to our compliance officer so we have that record of it. So that was provided in Outlook 2013. That was provided in Outlook Web App. You have that policy tip. We had data loss prevention capabilities in SharePoint as well, but it was much more reactive. So rather than being proactive and notifying users as things are happening, the initial phase of data loss prevention in SharePoint and OneDrive for Business was about you going through the e-discovery capabilities and being able to search back, saying, show me where people have stored credit card numbers in OneDrive for Business. You know, it lets you go and search for it, but it didn't let you get in the way when they were actually doing it. So now we're rolling out capabilities that do allow you to be proactive. So that's on the next slide. And then integration into Office as well as part of our next release, or our new release. So the policy tips in SharePoint, you can see we can define these policies, do things like you can't store files in here if it contains this sensitive information. Actually, what I forgot to mention was that we had 51 sensitive information types. We've added another 30, and you can define your own as well. So if you've got specific customer ID numbers that you wanted to alert on, or employee ID numbers, or keywords, or something like that, through XML you can roll your own sensitive information type. If you've got templates that typically get filled out, so a new customer application form or something like that, you can feed the blank templates into the data loss prevention system, and it can take a fingerprint of that, and then it can detect when it sees a completed form going through and treat that as a sensitive information type as well. So the capabilities that we're adding to SharePoint, obviously allowing you to be proactive. The idea being that we want to let users know in real time that something has happened, that it's not allowed. We want to give them the ability to correct that behavior. I think that the key thing there being productivity. So if we trap an email going outside the organization containing credit card numbers, you know, maybe we don't get it in time and the user's actually able to send it. We generate a non-delivery report, we bounce it back to the user, this was not delivered because you violated policy. What if the user's gone home and doesn't see that until the next day? You know, you caused a delay, you've impacted productivity for that user and whatever else they were doing. So if we can pop up in real time to say this is a violation, maybe do something else, it's impacting behavior. So again, not trying to stop the malicious actors, but trying to catch that behavior that people are doing by accident and giving them an alternative. And so the same thing is happening in your Office 2016 applications now. So Outlook, Word, Excel, PowerPoint. You'll see we get this policy tip come up that says it conflicts with the policy of your organization. And then you can go into the backstage and you can actually see a little bit more detail about what that is and how you can resolve it. So if they don't have Office 2016, you still get the SharePoint experience. It's still going to save it into SharePoint. It's going to be locked down by SharePoint, only available to you and the site owner. Nobody else can access that content potentially. But yeah. So hopefully you've seen the Compliance Center. You're familiar with the Compliance Center. Compliance Center was something that we released to unify all of this. So instead of having to go to all these individual places and say, I want to configure my data loss prevention for Exchange, I want to configure my data loss prevention for OneDrive for Business or SharePoint, Compliance Center kind of rolls up all of that DLP and auditing and e-discovery kind of functionality and puts it all in one place that you can then go and delegate out to your compliance people. So we have some capabilities for DLP inside the Compliance Center where you can go through and do a single pane of glass, go and configure that policy, and then pick up some reporting from there as well. Okay. So hopefully you're aware, if you've got Exchange Online, we give you Exchange Online protection as part of that. So Exchange Online protection is our antivirus, anti-malware, anti-spam sort of solution, the gateway that sits in front of your email, does the scanning. EOP is doing definition-based scanning, so it's looking for a definition that's, you know, for that virus or for that piece of malware. So EOP is great, but we're seeing a very sophisticated level of attack now. So things that change on a regular basis, you know, URLs that come out and change on the back end, so that users are being redirected to services, or applications that change every 24 hours. So before the virus definitions can pick that up and detect it, we're getting these zero-day attacks. So in order to combat that, we have this thing called advanced threat protection. So this is something that you can enable for all users or for a selection of users, depending on what your risk profile is. And really what this does is, after it passes through the Exchange Online Protection engine, so we're looking based on signatures to see if this is infected with something, we can go and put it through the pipeline for ATP, and ATP can then go and make some decisions about it. So if we see an attachment, we're going to take that attachment out of the email and put it over here in a detonation chamber or a sandbox environment. So we can then choose to continue to deliver the email and just hold on to the attachment until we've evaluated that, or we can hold everything and do the evaluation and then pass it on when we know it's good. But basically, we put it inside that that virtualized environment, and we let it run, and we see what happens. We compare the difference, so that the known state that it started with, what happened afterwards. So that way, we can look at, you know, did it actually execute something? Did it make registry calls? Did it try to get out to the network? Did it change files on the file system? If we see any of that sort of behavior, then obviously we deem it unsafe, and we can turf it. But if it looks good, then we can allow that attachment to go through. So we'll do some evaluation on the URLs at that point. So the safe links piece, you can actually see this in effect. If you happen to email one of us at Microsoft and we reply to you, you'll see that every single URL in your message has been rewritten. So even at the bottom in your mouse, in your signature, where it's, you know, www.mycompany.com, when you get that email back from us, because we have ATP checking our mailboxes, you'll see it's been rewritten to something like, you know, na01.safelinks.microsoft. It's going to have the user account of the person at Microsoft that you sent that to. And that's because we're tracking all of these URLs. We can have them back in a master database. So if something changes, everything's fine today, but, you know, tomorrow we realize this is malware and this is leading you to a bad website, we can lock that URL down, and now it doesn't matter where you are, you can't get to that URL. So, you know, previously you might have dealt with this inside the organization with a proxy server, you block that URL, but it doesn't really help you when everybody's outside your network. It's not going to help you when you've got mobile devices or people connecting from home or something like that. So this is really giving you that ability to kill that URL if we find out that there's something bad about it. Okay. Encryption. So this is really the encryption of your content. This is the encryption that you control. And there are a couple of different reasons why you might want to encrypt content. So the first scenario being, I want to deliver some information to someone, and I want it to be secure in that transmission, in that delivery. I want to validate your identity. I want to make sure that you receiving the information are the person I expect you to be. But then after that, I'm done. I'm out of the chain. So this is typically things like a bank statement or a health record or something like that, where I'm giving you your information, and after I've provided it and we're happy with it, it's on you to protect that information. I don't really want to put a policy on your bank statement that requires you to authenticate against my system every time you want to open your statement. It's going to be a bit of a pain if you're trying to provide that statement to your accountant or something like that. So that's where we would use something like Office 365 message encryption. So Office 365 message encryption is or OME, you would see it abbreviated as, is something that we would call typically through a policy. You as the administrators would define rules that say if you see this particular sensitive information content through DLP, or you see these keywords or some other condition, then we want to apply Office 365 message encryption. We're actually providing a button now as well, so you'll be able to, as a user, say encrypt with Office 365 message encryption if you wanted to force that. But it basically does that encryption, and then it sends an email to the recipient with a redirection to our secure portal. So they click on that link, they go to our secure portal, they authenticate with their email address, so it could be a live ID or something. So they'll authenticate, they'll get into our secure portal. If they wanted to reply to us, they could. That'll preserve that encryption. But at that point, they can take that statement that I provided, they can save it on their computer, and we're done. So I've done secure delivery. I should have noted that we have encryption in transit already, so we have opportunistic TLS turned on, and you can force TLS. So it's not protecting the transmission itself. I'm not trying to mitigate against somebody sniffing the wire and taking my email. This is really about ensuring that secure delivery of the message through Office 365 message encryption. If I want to go a step beyond that, say I've got content that I want to protect forever, that's where we use something like Office 365 rights management or Azure rights management. So we have this as part of your Office 365 licensing as well. You have the capability to turn this on within Exchange Online, within SharePoint Online, even in the Office clients. So we have what we call enlightened applications. These are applications that natively support RMS capabilities. So it's a, if you're not familiar, rights management services is a certificate-based technology where we can apply a policy to a file and you can restrict access. So I, as the content owner, would put some protection onto a file that says you can't print, you can't copy, you can't screenshot, something like that. I, as the copy, as the owner of that file, am the only one who can take the protection off. There's a super user from an administrator perspective if you, really need to take protection off if somebody leaves the organization. But once I've sent you a file, you don't have any control over it. You only have the rights that I've given you. So this is really good. You'll see it exposed through email in things like do not forward policies or do not reply all, commonly used. You can also do things like locking it down to particular groups or the organization. So we use it ourselves. We'll get emails that come out and they're protected with a rights management policy that's Microsoft confidential view only. So it means that even if I do try to screenshot that or copy and paste it, I can't do it. I might have a Microsoft FTE all rights policy, which basically means that you have to be a Microsoft employee to open that information. So I could then forward that information to another address. With the view only policy, I can't forward or reply. With the all rights policy, I can, but you have to be a member of that security group. We're going to force you to authenticate to open that mail. So now I know that that's not going outside my organization. If somebody does manage to forward that email out, they're not going to be able to open it unless they have a valid user account. And we can call this through other places as well. We can layer this into SharePoint. So you can have policies inside SharePoint Online that say anytime a file comes out of SharePoint, apply a policy to it. The nice thing there is that you can do things like enforcing sign-on. So somebody takes a file out of SharePoint, downloads it, puts it on their hard disk, you have a policy that automatically gets applied to that that says you have to authenticate every time you open that file, or you have to authenticate every 7 days, whatever it might be. Maybe this file only lives for 30 days, and then it can't be decrypted by anyone ever again. So now I'm forcing you to go back to SharePoint every 30 days to get the latest version of a document, which can be really handy when you've got content that expires, like a roadmap. I don't want people referring to a document that's 3 months old. I want to make sure they've got the latest version. I can do that with rights management. We put a lot of work into making sure that rights management worked across devices and outside your organization. So that's been happening over the last couple of years. Otherwise, rights management was a really good solution for Microsoft ecosystem inside the corporate network. Now you can do this on your Android phone, your iPhone. We have this as part of the Office applications on iOS now. So really opening it up, allowing you to share with people outside your organization too. So you can send a do not forward email and people will be able to pick that up. Finally, we do have support for S/MIME. I don't know if that's relevant to anybody in this room. It's fairly specific scenarios. We originally took it out and then we did put it back in because it was a requirement for mainly US defense organizations. But if you do want to do S/MIME, then S/MIME is a really good way to make sure that the content is protected between two people. All right. So as part of this rise of bring your own device, the feedback we were getting from our customers was that we really needed some sort of protection for that. And so what we did was we took some of the device management capabilities that we had in Intune and we made them available as part of your Office 365 licensing, similar to what we did with the rights management services or the Azure Active Directory functionality. So as part of your Office 365 licensing, you get these features on the left. You get conditional access, you get device management, you get selective wipe. And then if you want to go further, if you want the application management capabilities, that's where you can start bringing in Intune to look at that. So what does that mean? Conditional access is a great solution for ensuring that the device has to be registered with you before anyone can get access to the data. So it should be nice and easy. We don't want people having to go through these complex policies or involving IT, based on the self-service principles. We don't want special applications. You can see in this scenario, the user just goes out to the App Store and downloads the public OneDrive application. And they go to sign in using their corporate credentials. They're going to get prompted to enroll the device. So they go, hit the service, enroll the device. We do some, checks on the device. We decide that that's okay. Activation is successful. We've now wrapped that application. They can get in and get their data. Okay, so pretty simple. We have to enroll to access the content. That's what conditional access means. Now, device management is where we actually get to control who gets to enroll. So as part of enrolling into the mobile device management solution, we get to enforce some policies on your device. We do some checks on the state of it. So something like the device can't be jailbroken or rooted for iOS or Android. We want to make sure that you haven't compromised that device. We know what the state of that device is. or requiring encryption. We won't let you get your email unless you've got encryption on, which is easy enough on Windows and iOS. It might be an additional step for you on Android to go and turn that on. But that's a policy that you can enforce so that you know that the data is not sitting unencrypted on that device. Or something simple like setting a password. You know, it must meet certain complexity requirements. It must be 4 characters or 6 characters. Pretty important when you think about the phone being that second factor for your authentication through the MFA solution. So you have the ability to go and enforce these policies. You have control over users. You can set up different groups, so different groups get different policies. You have all of the reporting coming through here, so you can see what people are doing, who's enrolling, what sort of devices are they using, and of course you have APIs to manage this. And then selective wipe. So obviously, well, you may know through ActiveSync we have the ability to wipe a device. So in the past, people signing up for your email system, we have the ability to wipe that device if we really wanted to, which is great when we're supplying that device. But when you've got bring your own device, users probably not going to be happy if we wipe out all their personal photos and emails and everything else that's stored on there. So obviously, you still need that control. You want that level of comfort. They want to keep their data. So that's why we've got the selective wipe capability. So again, public OneDrive application on the iPad. You may have seen that we're moving to single application for these sorts of things. So there's one OneDrive application now. There's not OneDrive Personal and OneDrive for Business, it's OneDrive. And that OneDrive application can connect to both services. But inside the application itself, it's smart enough to know that this is the personal piece, this is the business piece. If we want to do a selective wipe on the business data, I'm just going to eliminate that container of information. So I can leave all of the user's personal OneDrive features or files on the device, not take that out. Same sort of thing with email. As part of that device enrollment, we push down the mail profile to the device, so we own that. We can wipe that if the user leaves the organization without touching the rest of their data. Now, if you want to go beyond that, if you want to control the applications themselves and what users can do within those applications, that's where we start looking at Intune. Now, in the past, we would have said Intune is the only solution that can do this. And if you've got another mobile device management solution, then that might be a bit of a problem. We now have mobile application management, so we can manage the applications themselves without actually managing the device. Which means if you have an MDM solution, we're not asking you to rip it out and put Intune in to get these capabilities. You can do that with Intune mobile application management. If you've got personal devices that the users really don't want you enforcing policies on, we don't have to enroll those devices and have control over, you know, blocking the camera or preventing them from using certain services. We can just control what they're doing inside their email and Word, Excel, PowerPoint sort of things through Intune. So it's basically creating this walled garden idea. So you as administrators get to control who's inside that secure trust boundary, what can flow inside that boundary, and what they can do with the applications. So let's look at an example. You can see in this particular scenario on this iPad, we have this container inside the orange lines. So this is our business layer. This is what you're managing. And we're not going and getting special applications for this. We're using the standard applications that users are going to go and get from the store. So we haven't had to create specific versions of Word. You know, we're not having functionality differences between a managed application versus a non-managed application. You as administrators are just defining what fits inside that walled garden. And so the applications themselves are smart enough to understand where the information is coming from and what they should do in that scenario. So in this particular case, Sarah goes and tries to connect to her mail. She gets blocked. So this is still sort of focused on that MDM scenario. She gets blocked. We do conditional access, which is what we just talked about. So she enrolls the tablet. Now we're allowing her to get through to her email. So that lights up in the native mail application or Outlook or whatever that is. Sarah then tries to access OneDrive. She tries to save to OneDrive from her mailbox. She's going to get blocked because OneDrive is outside that trusted boundary. But if she wants to save to OneDrive for Business, that's okay. Because again, you've controlled that. You've defined that OneDrive for Business is a safe location. And she can take that content, she can put it into PowerPoint, she can work on it, that's fine. But if she wants to copy and paste out of PowerPoint and put it into an unmanaged application, we're going to deny that. So you can't take something from your email or take something from Word and paste that into Twitter and leak it out that way. Twitter's an unmanaged application. So, you know, as I said, you have control over that. You as administrators get to define that. When Sarah leaves the organization, you can wipe the applications that you might have pushed down. You can leave the applications that she's downloaded from the store. You can leave her personal data. You've just got rid of all the corporate data off the device. So that sort of capability, being able to control information coming out of Outlook and not being allowed to go into Word if it's going into OneDrive, but it is okay to go into Word if it's going into OneDrive for Business. That's the sort of thing you can do with Intune MAM, the mobile application management, and you can do that now without having to replace your existing MDM or without having to do device enrollment if you really want to. So from a security perspective, if we wrap up that part, we are a little different. So our capabilities might look a little different to some of the other players out there. I think the key thing for us is really that it's about productivity at the end of the day. We don't want to break that productivity experience. We want users to use the applications they're familiar with. We want you to have the control over it. We want it to be nice and easy, built in. You just turn it on, use it, turn it off when you don't need it. Common identity, any device, any operating system. And that's why you'll actually see that a lot of the management capabilities are there first and foremost in iOS. That's where the bulk of our users are. That's where we focused on first. iOS has the best story today for management. Android is there as well. We obviously pick up a lot of capabilities with Windows Phone 10, but we've gone where the users are. Okay, so let's talk about compliance. Hopefully you've seen that we have data centers in Australia now, as of early this year. So we operate a regionalized data center strategy. It used to be North America, Europe, Asia Pacific, and then we put in a data center specifically for Brazil. We've started putting data centers into other regions now because of data residency requirements. So we have data centers in Australia. We have data centers in Japan, in India. If you sign up for an Office 365 tenant today, you automatically land in the Australian data center. If you had signed up previously, you were probably provisioned in Asia Pacific, and everybody with Australia as their country will be moved back into the Australian data centers over the next 6 to 12 months. We've seen quite a lot of customers go already as part of our beta program and then opening up the scale move. Everybody else will come over in the next 6 to 12 months unless you specifically opt out. If you do opt out, that's a one-time decision. You stay there forever. But we'll do that move for you automatically. It's basically transparent to you. So you'll then come back and work in Australia and you pick up some additional benefits in terms of latency as well. When we talk about compliance, compliance is definitely not a checkbox exercise for us. It's something that's very important. We have this idea of continuous compliance. So when we started out doing this, obviously there were certain requirements we had to meet in terms of proving that trust, earning that trust. So we would take our developers, our engineering teams, pull them out of their day job, sit them down with the auditors, go through the service. They would complete the ISO 27001 audit. They'd go back to their day job, and then we'd pull them back out a month later to go and do something like SAS 70. It's not really the best use of time. So we've set up a dedicated group that's responsible for compliance inside our online services. And we've developed a control framework. So we have over 1,000 controls in our framework. We sort of look for the highest bar. So that's basically the FISMA certification, which is based on NIST 853, if you're interested. Quite a long document if you really want to read it. But over 1,000 controls. So it means that when something comes along, we want to do our ISO audit, for example. ISO, I think, is about 130-odd controls in the latest revision. So we take the requirements of that control framework, we map it to our 1,000-odd controls, and you might see that in order for every one control domain inside ISO, we have 6 or 7 control objectives in our framework that match. So it's a much better exercise for us to just sit down and do that mapping than to try and look at the individual requirements of every certification and how we meet that. So you'll see that we've gone and done things that customers have asked for. We have HIPAA certification or the FERPA and FISMA and all those sorts of things that are mainly US-centric. The big things globally, I guess, are the SSA 16, SOC 1, SOC 2, which is not listed on there. ISO 27001, we just completed, or at the beginning of the year, we did ISO 27001 2013, so the latest revision. And as part of that, we did the assessment for the ISO 27018 privacy controls. So we're the first cloud vendor to have gone through the ISO 27018 framework, specifically around privacy of data. I'm assuming there's probably not a lot of people in this room that are affected by the collapse of the Safe Harbor Agreement between the US and Europe. But if that was something that was of concern to you, we still have a pretty strong story through the European model clauses. And I'm happy to talk to that specifically afterwards if that's of concern. At the local level, the big one for us is our IRAP certification that we did, I guess, beginning of the year. So the IRAP program is done by the Australian Signals Directorate, obviously very important if you're a government customer or you work with government customers. So basically, you can come and talk to us about this. We can give you the letter that states our compliance and the level that we've achieved. If you need it, we can also give you the IRAP report under non-disclosure agreement so you can read through all of that. So it's very specific, obviously, to government, but it's certainly there if you need it. Also, from a financial services perspective, we have got financial services customers in Australia on Office 365. We've done a lot of work with APRA so that we can meet their requirements for material outsourcing. So if that applies to you, you would talk to your account team. We can certainly help you with that piece of work. We also have a program specifically for financial services customers because they do have some very unique requirements. It's been available for a couple of years, but we recently opened it up, so it's sort of broadly available. Again, only to financial services customers, but it's something that they can opt into for a fee, and it's really designed to meet the right to audit that's typically provided that's typically imposed by a regulator. So we can provide some additional capabilities on that. But the great thing about this is that through that program, we've led to a number of other developments that benefit the rest of our customers. So the specific example would be this Service Trust Portal. Does anybody know about Service Trust Portal? Okay. So Service Trust Portal is something that we've done. In the past, if you needed information on Office 365, as I said, the Trust Portal is out there, trustoffice365.com. That was a place where you could go and get public information on the certifications we have or how we do the service. There's some white papers in there like the Office 365 security white paper that talks through all of the sort of controls, how we do the physical security and network security and that sort of thing. There's a white paper in there on Office 365 customer controls that talks to how do you do things like rights management and data loss prevention and e-discovery and all those sorts of things. So the Trust Center had a lot of great content in it, but because of the requirements, I guess, imposed on us by certain regulators or certain auditors and that sort of thing, if you needed things like a SOC 2 audit report, you would have to come to your Microsoft account team and we would have to make a request. And that was meant to be an auditor to auditor report. So we would send the request through and our audit team would send the report directly to your audit team. Anybody ever wanted to read the audit reports? Find the true nerds in the audience? No? Maybe just me. So the great thing about the Service Trust Portal is that we now make this available to you. So you as an Office 365 administrator can go to trustportal.office.com, you can sign in, you can go and delegate access to other people inside your organization, so your compliance people, your legal people, you can give them access to sign into this site. And through here you can come in and say, I'm coming from Australia and I'm in government. So it's going to give you a filtered view of what's going to be relevant for Australia and government. So you can go and get the SOC 1 and SOC 2 audit reports, which previously we weren't allowed to even read ourselves. You can get all of the information on you know, our certifications. There's a whole bunch of other, you can see 9 trust documents available. So there's a document in there on how we do things like denial of service protection in the service, all sorts of information in there that you can utilize. And so this is a great resource. Again, this idea that you don't have to come to us. There are gonna be some things that you still need to talk to us about, the IRAP assessment in particular. That's still something that you come to us for. But you can sign up, you can get into this. Even as a trial customer, you can get into this because we want that transparency. We want you to have that trust in our service. Go and get the reports, do the assessment that you need to do. You know, make sure Office 365 is going to be right for you. Compliance. A lot of this starts to get a little marketing fluffy stuff, to be honest. There's a lot of stuff in here on compliance. Why is compliance important? So we've heard from customers, you need to be able to archive your important content, you need to be able to find that, you need to be able to monitor what's going on with it. So our vision for that is really, again, we want that productivity experience. We want to preserve that. We want to make sure that we're helping users to be compliant. So that's things like the real-time notification with policy tips in data loss prevention. You're doing something that's wrong, let me tell you why it's wrong and how you could do it better, rather than just getting an error message. In place is a big principle for us. We don't want you to have to go and build up these expensive, complex systems to do your archiving or your e-discovery. Do it where the data is. You eliminate all the issues with upgrades and compatibility and that sort of thing. Have those capabilities built in and you can light them up and use them. And then eventually we want these capabilities to apply to every feature across every part of the service. So we have a really good story with Exchange and SharePoint and OneDrive for Business today. But you'll see things like groups and that sort of thing coming in as well. So the Compliance Center is kind of the key piece that we're utilizing for this. Compliance Center drives all of these functionality across the product set, but there's some key pillars there being archiving, e-discovery, auditing, and our Quivio analytics. Why is archiving important? Litigation, pretty important. Business continuity, regulations. Obviously, there's going to be different requirements for different industries. You might have a requirement to keep data for 7 years. Genetics company might have a requirement to keep data for 100 years. That's up to you to configure based on whatever you need to do. So we have some archiving capabilities built in, again, based on this idea of in-place retention. So you can set a hold. We don't have to go and do journaling and have a copy of your mail being put over there. We can preserve it in place. We can preserve everything, or we can do a select amount of that, so based on time period or based on keywords. When that expires, we can allow that content to be destroyed. We have policies that apply across Exchange, SharePoint, and Skype for Business, because Skype for Business is storing data in your Exchange mailbox, nice and easy for you to manage. And then extensible. We actually can take data from third-party systems through third-party tools, inject that into this environment, so you can then do the same thing with eDiscovery across that. Data import service Ben's going to cover tomorrow, but it's essentially we have this ability for you to ingest data over the network, or you can put data on hard drives and you can ship them to us and do an import that way. And we have unlimited archiving for your mailboxes. So there's no add-ons, there's no licensing fees. You have a user, you put them on hold, they leave the organization, you get to free up that license, give it to somebody else, the data stays there and you don't have to pay for it. The policies, I think, is really interesting. The obvious one is that we want to preserve content for a period of time. So I have a requirement under, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, whatever it is, that I need to preserve for 7 years. That's great, but deletion, I think, is where it really comes into play, the deletion policies. Oftentimes we get customers that say, all right, well, if it's free, why don't I just keep everything? And you can if you want to, but remember that you're obligated to produce everything if you get subpoenaed. So if somebody subpoenas you and says, I want every record of your interaction with Contoso, do you want to filter through 3 years worth of data, or do you want to filter through 20 years worth of data to find all the stuff that's relevant? So again, that's a position for your organization to make. That's a decision for you to figure out. But deletion policies can be really useful for that, because we can make sure we're not keeping data around forever and having to filter through that. Because there's some pretty significant consequences. $9 million fine for failing to produce customer emails. So this is a big deal. We want to make it nice and easy. We have e-discovery capabilities in Office 365. We have an e-discovery center within SharePoint that you can use. So it's just like a SharePoint site. You can apply a hold, you can search for data, you can find sensitive information. You can export that, you can refine it down. We want to end up with as little information as possible being sent to outside counsel, because those lawyers will charge you per gigabyte or per page. So it can be quite expensive to have them filtering through content, figuring out what's relevant for trial. So the amount of content you can reduce obviously makes a huge difference. Quivio Analytics can help with that as well. What's been found is that when humans filter through the data, it's often prone to error. So I can go through and I can search for Contoso, and I can refine it down and say Contoso near acquisition, or there's five occurrences of that word, or whatever the case may be. But machine learning can actually produce much more efficient results. So basically I train the environment, I let it look at some content, it figures out what looks similar, so we can eliminate some of the nearly identical information. It can recreate email threads, basically putting structure into unstructured data and help us refine that set that comes out at the end of it. Auditing, I think we've already talked about a little bit through the Activity API, just this idea that we would have consistent logging across all of the services. We have that record of everything that's done to the environment. You do have, as part of the reporting system, a 90-day retention with your Office 365 licensing, so you have 90 days worth of auditing history inside the product. If you want to use the Activity API to take data out, put it into a security event monitoring system, you can do whatever you want with it in your own environment. So that was kind of everything I wanted to jam into the presentation. And I think we have about 10 minutes left for questions, hopefully. Was that useful? Are people's eyes glazed over? Are you? Yeah? All right, happy to take questions if people want to do it now. I'll stick around afterwards and you can do it if you don't want to do it in front of the crowd. There are a few things in here that we may as well just cover. Please do an evaluation. I would like to know what I did wrong so I can fix it. So, and of course you can win a prize too, but you know, I'm more interested in me. There are some related sessions. James and Simon have that session tomorrow. Ben and Ronnie have the session as well on data import. The resources that I mentioned, so obviously the Office 365 Trust Center is still the first point of contact for all this information. We want to be very transparent. We want to make as much available to you as possible through there. And then you have the Trust Portal for authenticated users for anything else like audit reports. The Office 365 blog is really the best place that we communicate out all of these features, new announcements, all of that sort of thing. So great idea to go and follow that. And then because I went sort of at a higher level, if you wanted to look for more information specifically on how things work, we have those recordings from Ignite in Chicago earlier in the year. Sarah does a presentation on how we do security and control, and then Vikas is doing the next generation services. So very much much deeper look at security and compliance as well. I didn't put a link in it, but there is actually a Microsoft security course for Office 365 as part of the Virtual Academy. So that's also something that's worth looking at if that's an area of interest to you. And then obviously all of these presentations will be up on Channel 9 within a little while. The Office 365 network is there, so you can continue the conversation. And we will be at the happy hour tonight if you have questions, if you want to come have some drinks and I think win some prizes. And in the community lounge, we'll be doing that tonight. So I think with that, we can wrap it up. And if there's any questions, happy to take them now or, yeah. How would you stop? Okay, so how would you stop people using the native mail client on iOS or Android? Is that the question? The native mail client on iOS, I believe, should support rights management. I honestly haven't used it in a while, but I used to use an iPhone, and I'm pretty sure I was getting emails from that. I honestly don't know. I think Android does, but I'd have to check. You should be able to do things with an active sync policy, I would think, to be able to block those devices if you didn't want it to use that. I might have to check that one, but I'm happy to, if you come and find me, I can follow up on that one.
Is he talking about a recipient using the native mail client, a recipient of an RMS protected email?
That's a good point. Are you talking about sending it to somebody and they're using the native clients, or are you talking about just your users, you don't want them to use those clients because it doesn't support? You want your own users. Okay. Right. Yep. Yeah, I think there's obviously some functionality in the native mail client that we're just not going to have. I'll check it for you. I'm fairly certain we do have rights management capabilities in the native mail client on iOS. But things like the data loss prevention capabilities, we do have an Outlook client or OWA for devices, which is sort of the full functionality right now because it's a copy of the web client. There's obviously the Outlook client for iOS as well, which is basically our Acompli acquisition. So the functionality there is catching up a bit, but you've got lots of different choices depending on. Yep. Okay. Yeah, no, it's I'm going to have to check that because I don't really do mobile application management, so let me fix it.
Wouldn't the RMS protected message be encrypted so you'd need a client to
Yeah, the RMS protected message certainly is. If your client doesn't support it, you're going to get an RPMSG attachment that you can't open. So the RMS perspective is probably not that big a deal. I guess the copying from the native client to something other application, I'm pretty sure we do support that. Like, we block that. I just have to look at the MAM policies.
Just regarding the SharePoint Online.
Yeah.
So they've got the ULS logs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Not access right now. That has to come through, you know, support team to you guys. And then is it any way?
The logs for SharePoint Online? Yeah, the Activity API is going to expose a lot of that all that information to you. You'll have that directly.
Security concern on that
one?
I
don't believe so. I mean, you have to be an authenticated user, I guess, to get to the API. Happy to talk to you about what the concern might be. Cool. Sorry, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Now with the Yammer, in the unstructured context, data leakage is very, very... I want to know Microsoft's take because I can't get quite a clear answer out of this. There's nothing stopping someone from breaching by posting into a Yammer group, whether it's using Yammer embed, using their API,
mm-hmm.
and because you can't enforce those types of policies, that unstructured information that gets posted straight away, data sovereignty. When
yep.
is Microsoft going to start focusing on looking at unstructured information that gets published as just as important as structured information? Because
yep.
whilst we can do DRM and rights management and that against the structured information, that chit chat is
yep.
going to be just as important as that document. So if I do an announcement to a Yammer group
mm-hmm.
to say companies are laying off 1,200 people, that's already outside your firewall. In North America,
yeah.
And what I heard just of late from Microsoft in Melbourne is there's no roadmap to localize Yammer onshore at this point in time.
Correct.
Because using Yammer in a state or a federal government perspective, when they get regulated or audited,
yeah.
And pretty much you want to be able to dig up that conversation that may have taken place against that document. I might be having a chit chat back and forth with colleagues in an organisation about that particular document,
yep.
but something's been said out of context, and then when you get, you know, audited, that conversation's going to have to be dug up. It's going to have to be dug up from North America using the export API that Yammer provides, not what Office 365 provides.
Yeah.
So I just want to know how Office 365 is tackling the unstructured information within the platform.
Yeah, so the question is on the way we're handling data in Yammer. In particular, the unstructured data and how we would do that from a discovery and preservation and that sort of perspective. So Yammer's been an interesting one to integrate into Office 365. Sort of, there are some big changes. There's a document that talks to compliance standards, and Yammer was kind of in that tier A standard. So we finally managed to get it into the Microsoft data centers. We managed to get rid of all the third-party components so that it does actually meet, you know, those requirements. But yeah, Yammer is still offshore. There is no roadmap to bring Yammer inside, like to geographically disperse Yammer. So it will still sit in the North American data centers for the time being.
So we're talking about National Archiving Standards and the ISO 16175 and those type of standards that state and federal have got to meet.
Yep.
Documents are looked after by your records management team through that ISO process. But that conversation is going to have to be addressed as well in the policies around that.
Yeah, so Yammer does have some preservation capabilities and some discovery capabilities. They're definitely not in the same vein as the Office 365 ones today. It will improve over time. I think there are some things that you would look at. So maybe you could use Office 365 groups instead of Yammer for certain scenarios, because now we're putting Insight Exchange and SharePoint where we are going to pick up DLP and things like that. Or it comes down to a risk assessment decision. So if I provide Yammer, then I've got this issue of data sitting in the US data centers. If I don't provide Yammer, where are my users going to go to have this conversation? So you know, you're going to get this shadow IT problem. So there's a whole lot of aspects that tie into it, but you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Yammer is definitely lagging in that area. So you will see it improve.
Yep.
We're hitting TSC compliance, I think, right now. So you'll see a number of things come in as part of that, and there'll be some announcements around that. But it's definitely a challenge.
Whilst most organisations that buy into Office 365 and Yammer,
mm-hmm.
looking at you can have the chit chat in Yammer.
Yeah.
It's in North America, and when you get ordered, can you get that conversation back that where it's where that conversation went wrong?
Yeah.
Whilst the API can use an export feed from Yammer, it's very limited.
Yeah, it's definitely a different story.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool. Thanks. Sorry, there was over here somewhere. Yep.
You mentioned there's a button been added to allow the users to choose to use IP.
Yep.
Whereabouts is that
button? It'll be added into the ribbon in Outlook so that you can do that, an Outlook web app. So it's in the roadmap to do that.
The web app, or is it
going? I believe it'll be in the web app as well. It's not there today, but it's in the roadmap to give you that capability. Someone at the back? No? Okay. Great, thank you.